Studio 360.
It's not even 11 o'clock yet. I bet we could go see a midnight movie.
That's Drew Carey in an episode of The Drew Carey Show from 20 years ago.
I'm talking about the midnight movie, the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh my God, we haven't done that since high school.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Let's do it!
Yeah, okay. Only this time we won't get wasted and question our sexuality. Like everyone except me did.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show came out when I was in college. Before Rocky Horror became a movie, it was a live show conceived in Britain and imported to America. And for the next installment of our American Icon series, we asked June Thomas, who was also conceived in Britain and also imported to America, to tell the story of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey.
When the Rocky Horror Picture Show was first released in 1975, it flopped spectacularly. Variety found its campy hijinks labored, and Newsweek called it tasteless, plotless, pointless. But after all those terrible reviews, something happened.
It was a night out they were going to remember for a very long time.
Small independent theaters programmed it as a midnight movie, and audience members started talking back to the screen. The participation became more important than the film itself, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show became a phenomenon. It would end up shattering the record for the longest-running theatrical release in movie history, because people kept coming back.
I saw it 80 times in high school.
Well, I remember celebrating, you know, my 100th and then my 500th.
Maybe a couple thousand? So if I sat down and did the math, I might cry.
More than 40 years after its debut, the Rocky Horror Picture Show still fills movie theaters all across America. Maybe not the 230 venues of 1979, but you can still see it year-round in 80 or so U.S. towns and cities. But why has its appeal endured? Well, for one thing, it's all about sex.
On the surface, it's this incredible celebration of individuality and nonconformity and cultural freedom that really speaks to people.
That's Scott Miller, artistic director of the New Line Theatre in St. Louis.
But I think on a deeper level, Rocky Horror really is about the sexual revolution in America and how insane the country went over the sexual revolution.
In the movie, Brad and Janet, a newly engaged couple played by Barry Boswick and Susan Sarandon,
I love you.
Seek shelter in a remote castle.
Come inside.
They find themselves at a strange gathering.
You've arrived on a rather special night. It's one of the master's affairs.
Oh.
Where Dr. Frankenfurter,
enchanté,
a cross-dressing mad scientist, played with over-the-top charm by Tim Curry,
and what charming underclothes you both have,
is about to reveal his latest creation, Rocky, the man of his dreams.
I can make you a man.
Frank quickly seduces both Brad and Janet.
You tricked me! I wouldn't have. I've never, never.
Yes, yes, I know. But it isn't all bad, is it?
Kills a biker named Eddie.
It was a mercy killing.
And tricks his guests into eating Eddie's flesh.
That's a rather tender subject. Another slice, anyone?
On a British chat show, Richard O'Brien, who wrote Rocky Horror and played Riff Raff, described the plot another way.
I think the reason for its longevity is that it's a fairy tale, and it's a retelling of Genesis. Brad and Janet are Adam and Eve, and the serpent is Frankenfurter.
Or as Scott Miller put it,
it's about two young people who go into the woods and find themselves. The woods is the place where you go and kind of what you think is torn apart and reconstructed for you. And so Brad and Janet go into the woods. They are forced to confront themselves, their own sexuality, their own feelings about that stuff, and they come out the other end changed people, just like in a Shakespeare play.
In the darkness of everybody's life.
I first saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show in Newark, Delaware in the early 1980s. Those boisterous late-night screenings were the closest thing the college town had to a gay bar. And as a newly arrived foreign grad student, it was the kind of uniquely American experience I craved. Which is odd, because O'Brien and almost all of his early collaborators were British or Australian. That doesn't surprise Scott Miller.
I think it took outsiders, non-Americans, to look at this moment in American cultural history and see the truth of it and the ridiculousness of it and the complexity of it.
And what they saw was a nation losing its mind over sex.
I'm just a sweet transvestite.
Frankenfurter represents the sexual revolution, the completely unfettered free sexuality, whatever the consequences.
Give yourself over to absolute pleasure.
And Brad and Janet are America reacting to this, grappling with this. Like a lot of America did, Brad is freaked out by it, tries to turn it back, is scared of it.
It's your fault. You're to blame. I thought it was the real thing.
Oh, come on, Brad, admit it. You liked it, didn't you?
And like a lot of America, Janet embraces it, arguably goes too far. And it leaves both of them shattered by the end, which is pretty much what the sexual revolution did to us.
At that precise moment in the mid-1970s, the hottest pop stars, think David Bowie, Freddie Mercury, and Mark Bolan, also happened to be stretching gender boundaries.
Frank has to be a glam rocker. Because glam rock was that one moment, that was some genre in rock and roll where gender was really fluid. And that's what was scary to people in the late 60s, early 70s. And that's what's scary to Brad and Janet.
I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover.
That's what makes Frank the monster, quote unquote, that we don't know his gender. It's fluid. It's both. It's neither, you know.
There was a lot going on with Tim Curry's Frankenfurter.
I play Frankenfurter. He is a kind of new variation on the mad scientist of horror films that we all know and love. It is parody, but it also, I play it and think it as a kind of grisly reality.
His ripped clothing prefigured the aesthetics of the punk movement. His mad scientist act reflected post-atom bomb anxiety about humans playing God. And his unruly sexual energy updated an entire movie genre.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still. But he told us where we stand.
The science fiction and horror movies in the first half of the 20th century were full of sublimated sex, you know, sex just under the surface. And Rocky Horror kind of acknowledges that and just yanks all of it up to the surface.
Do you think Frank is the hero of this show? I mean,
I don't. And the answer is, it's Janet. She's the one who learns the most and changes the most over the course of the story. She's a really different person at the end of the story than she is at the beginning. Brad is somewhat, but not nearly to the same extent. This is Janet's hero myth story.
Oh, if only we hadn't made this journey. If only the car hadn't broken down.
She has to go through these trials and tribulations and learn things. She goes to the underworld, quote unquote, and comes out the other side with new knowledge and new wisdom.
Planet, schmanet, Janet, you better wise up, Janet Wise.
He might not be the hero, but Frankenfurter is undoubtedly the pulsating engine of the musical.
Tim Curry is just this magical combination of rock and roll and theater. Just doesn't shy away from any kind of theatrical gesture. And here's a part where it's encouraged and yet has the vocal chops and the rock and roll chops.
That's Mark Shaiman, the Grammy, Emmy, and Tony-winning composer and lyricist best known for Hairspray. We talked while he was at the piano in his home studio.
So it all just comes together in this wonderful bouillabaisse of music and theater and campiness and his... The way he sometimes puts on airs like an old movie actress, and it's all just wonderful. How do you see you've met my faithful handyman? How's it go? That's not exactly right. There we go. You wouldn't have noticed the difference. And now I can't remember any of the lyrics. I'm just a sweet transvestite. From transsexual Transylvania.
Shaiman was one of those people who went to the Waverly Theatre in New York's Greenwich Village every weekend.
When I went to see Rocky Horror, yeah, that was yet another musical that was teaching me how rock and roll music and rock and roll lyrics can also certainly set a vibe and tell a story in a very different way from Rodgers and Hammerstein.
And while Rocky Horror used a new kind of music, it still followed a familiar formula.
It's a fairly traditional, old-school musical comedy. The first song introduces the themes and topics for the show. We meet the heroes one by one.
The river was deep, but I swam it.
Janet.
The future is ours, so let's plan it.
Janet.
So please, don't tell me to can it.
Janet.
I've one thing to say, and that's, damn it, Janet, I love you.
We get songs that say, this is who I am. We get songs that say, this is what I want.
Now all I want to know is how to go. I've tasted blood and I want more.
More, more, more.
We get all the traditional show tunes. What's subversive about it is that it's rock and roll, and particularly originally in London in 73 and 74, like pretty raw rock and roll, but it's got this very freaky, crazy content to it. That was part of what made it so alternative and so kind of, you know, naughty. It was that both traditional and totally not traditional all wrapped up together.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show wasn't just any old midnight movie. That's because, at some point in 1976, something happened that nobody was expecting, and it snowballed in a way that nobody could have predicted.
There was a guy, he was a kindergarten teacher, named Lewis.
That's Sal Piro, who attended more than 3,000 midnight movie screenings in New York City and later became president of the official Rocky Horror Picture Show fan club.
And he always sat in the balcony in the front row, and he had a great voice. One night, when Janet put a newspaper on her head and was walking in the rain, he just yelled out, to be funny, "Buy an umbrella, you cheap bitch." It was like, then it became like electrical. People were like, oh my God, that's funny. That's great. You know, we can add to our movie experience. And we started to think of things to yell.
And soon, talking in the movies wasn't the only rule that was being broken by the audience. When Brad and Janet are caught in a rainstorm, they shoot water pistols in the theater. When Frank proposes a toast, they toss slices of toast at the screen. And of course, they dance along with the time warp.
I've got to stop the ball.
Jeffrey Weinstock, a professor of English at Central Michigan University, has identified three distinct types of callbacks in the Rocky Horror canon.
The first is what I call predictive. Those are the moments where audience members demonstrate to the fullest their knowledge of the film because they preempt something that is to come.
Is it true that you're constipated?
It's true. There were dark forms.
Describe your ball.
Heavy, black, and pendulous.
That and the other early audience callouts we'll hear come courtesy of Say It, the Rocky Horror Picture Show audience participation album, recorded in New York in 1983.
There are then what I call simultaneous responses, and that's where the audience overlays their own comment upon something that's taking place on the screen.
Janet!
I just...
Janet!
Brad!
We're
Listen.
That round of applause at the end of the bit explains a lot about the thrill of Rocky Horror's interactivity. Members of the audience are congratulating themselves for getting it right.
The third category is what I call reactive. And this is a response from the audience to something that has just been said or has just taken place. There's a line later on when Rocky Horror says, is singing, "I'm just 7 hours old."
Behold. The Rocky Horror callbacks were like an early version of the internet meme, a series of building blocks that morphed and changed beyond the control or knowledge of their creators.
We were establishing the fan club with the studio, and my friend Alex and I went out to California. So, of course, we were going to see Rocky, see what they were doing. And I had a line that I had invented. The criminologist says, "And so..." And so I came up with this stupid line. And Betsy Ross used to sit home and so, and the criminologist looked down and went, "And so." And I thought, I'm the cleverest person ever. I traveled 3,000 miles, and I can't wait to yell my Betsy Ross line. And here I am at this theater that certainly had not started showing Rocky until after the Waverly. He's about to say "and so," and I'm about to yell out, and Betsy, all of a sudden, half of the theater was yelling,
"Betsy Ross used to sit home, and so, and so, and..."
"And so."
Wait a minute. It had traveled ahead of me. Other people who had seen it in New York or seen it in Chicago that moved to... It was such a weird phenomenon. We were very excited about it. We thought, gee, we helped make this.
"Don't dream it, be it."
The sight of Tim Curry's androgynous, outrageously sexy, sexually voracious Frankenfurter drew a new crowd to the theatre. People who were or saw themselves as outsiders, especially what we'd now call queer and gender nonconforming kids.
It's like I can't tell the story of my life without talking about Rocky Horror Picture Show, I think.
That's actress, writer, and activist Shakina Nafak. She first saw the movie in Los Angeles in the 1990s when she was a preteen.
"And I shoplifted fishnets and nail polish and eyeliner and like did all my makeup in a bathroom somewhere. After the movie was ended, I snuck into the restroom of the theater and like tried to clean it all off so that I got back in the car like looking like a normal 12-year-old kid."
Frank's presence was crucial.
It was the first time that I had ever seen someone like me in a movie.
For many hardcore fans, the Rocky Horror audience became the family many of its members lacked, a tribe that supported and loved them. But ever since the movie was first released, some people have worried that its unconventional representations of gender were a bad influence on America's youth. Shakina Nafak's parents had tried to discourage her from seeing the film.
My family and the authority figures in my life at school as well, saw Rocky Horror as this proselytizing of queerness and gender nonconformity that was really dangerous to the social order, which it is, thankfully. But I was really out and loud and proud as a young queer person in a time where that wasn't happening. It was the 90s were like the beginning of the queer youth movement, and I was really part of the forefront of that. And especially my queerness was expressed through alternative gender presentation, which really terrified people. There weren't a lot of other places you could go to look for that. I mean, maybe when The Birdcage came out and Tu Wong Fu, there was some drag in the consciousness, but that was like a different kind of camp. And Rocky Horror was sexual and ruckus and freewheeling and punk rock. And that's kind of what I brought, into my high school, which just really scared people. And I think when they tried to snuff that out of me, a way to do that was to snuff out Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Still, tastes, values, and attitudes were totally different in 1975. Why does this film, which may be beloved but is rarely acclaimed as a masterpiece, still captivate young people?
Rocky tends to operate in a kind of a nostalgic mode today.
Jeffrey Weinstock.
There's a nostalgia on the part of those who were part of the cult film phenomenon for a time when Rocky was risque rather than routine. And it may be that part of what is transgressive in Rocky's spectatorship today is indulging in a kind of anti-political correctness. That is, the same people who would go on a slut walk and would get outraged by the idea of slut shaming are the same ones who sort of gleefully will shout slut at Janet each time her name is said.
The very language of the show is awkward to 21st century ears. When the high schoolers on the TV show Glee performed a tribute to Rocky Horror, they changed the words transsexual Transylvania to
sensational Transylvania.
The word transsexual is a tricky word. It's a word that, you know, is dated. For me, I claim the label of transsexual a lot because so much of my journey has been about wanting to finally have an integrated, passionate, healthy sex life, to be a sexual being, which I could never be in the wrong body. And so to remove sex from that journey and that identity does a disservice to my own act of reclamation. So I say, leave the word, sing the word.
I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania.
And now, Frankenfurter, your time has come. Say goodbye to all of this.
At the end of the movie, Frankenfurter is murdered by his not-so-faithful servants, Riff Raff and Magenta. That outcome seems unavoidable to Jeffrey Weinstock.
Frank's reign, I've come to think, is a bit like the film itself. It's a temporary break from reality that can't persist. The ending, to my mind, is very much about the reassertion of order. But it seems inevitable to me. We didn't and still don't have a culture in which Frank's hedonism, not to mention murder and cannibalism, can reign unchecked.
No one watching the movie in the 1970s would have been surprised by that ending. In the movies it was parodying and in society as a whole, a proud, proselytizing pansexual couldn't be allowed to prosper. The outcasts who found family at Rocky Horror would expect that least of all. Still, if you were someone who held your tongue when being yelled at or bullied, those midnight screenings were a sanctuary. A place where, with water gun in one hand and toast in the other, you could finally yell back.
People always say, how could you put up with all the yelling and screaming and the cursing and the things like that? And you know what? That's all part of a bunch of young people letting themselves go, growing up, you know, going through puberty.
I think that Rocky Horror is benchmark. It is a time capsule of a really particular moment in queer liberation when the carnal celebration of queer desire became pop culture. That crossover really helped so many people.
I think what's appealing about Rocky is that it breaks lots of rules. The anarchy of screaming at the movie screen and throwing food at the movie screen. It was just so freeing and so wild. It feels subversive. I think it will always feel subversive as long as America is hung up on sex, which I think will be always.
It's just a jump to the left.
June Thomas produced our story with help from Studio 360's Jocelyn Gonzalez and production assistance from Tori Bedford. You can hear more of June on the terrific podcast she co-hosts, The Waves. And that's it for this installment of American Icons. Head to Studio360.org to hear the rest of our American Icons catalog. Dozens of stories and whole hours about the great works of art and culture America has produced. And to make sure you're the first to hear about the new American Icons stories we're making right now, subscribe to the podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts.